We're not seeking any input from out there, but we're making sure it's a public meeting. All right. Thank you, Scott. For those out there listening, this is Commissioner Brian Kalk. We're meeting on the 12th floor of the Capitol today. It is, what day is today? April 3rd, 2013. It's roughly 1:30. I will just open it up. This is going to be a general discussion from the commission and staff and some experts in the noise field about just general questions the commission might have, not tied to any case particularly, but I would note that for our own record that General Counsel Alana has recommended that we say that there is a relationship between potentially case number PU06421, which is another case in front of the commission. I don't believe we're going to be having any discussion on that. I don't want any discussion about the Keystone one. But, Alana, you thought it was a good idea, and I agreed with you that we should at least make reference to that because that kind of was a driver perhaps in some of this. Is there anything you'd have to add to that? Okay. I don't have anything particular agenda we want to follow. I do have some particular comments, questions, but I'd turn it over to Randy and Julie if you had any opening thoughts, and then I'll let Daryl take off.
Nope. I feel like my kids being the ages they are, I'm pretty familiar with noise. at all frequencies, yes. But I'm looking forward to getting more educated about the science of noise. Ours is very unscientific.
You know, I really wanted to get us started on something like this because after years and years of North Dakota's economy just dragging and nothing going on, now we have all these things happening, all these activities popping up, and things pop up not just in the heart of a coal mine or on the heart of an oil well pad, but all over the state where a lot of people have expectations of, you know, a quiet rural life. And as much as I want things to be happening and jobs to be being created and fortunes earned, I also want to treat people fairly that are out there too. And I can imagine on my own ranch, if something popped up a few hundred feet away from the farm site that made, you know, disturbing noise day in and day out. It's one thing to have something go by and create a ruckus. It's another thing when that happens all day, every day, month after month, and year after year. And I don't know how you regulate something that you can't measure. And so I think we really need to have a discussion with people who have expertise in this field, and looking forward to it.
Okay. Thank you, Randy. I think that kind of sets the stage a little bit. I had some notes about, I think the same thing Randy and Julie said, the science of noise, you know, potential health risks, some of the rules and regulations that might be out there. And I'm not looking at changing anything right now. It's just, but if we do decide to change something, there's some methodology behind it. I would just ask if any of the staff has any comments that you'd like to have on this, because you've been dealing with this a lot longer than I have. Any thoughts or concerns or anything from anybody? Pat, Mike, Sarah, Lana? No? Okay. Well, then, Daryl, we'll turn it over.
All right. I just, my comments are pretty basic. You know, I'm not an expert, so I hope the expert that we have with us can redirect me a little bit if I'm off. But I think it's interesting, and I've spent the last week really kind of researching as much as I could on noise, and granted, knowing kids and whatever. But noise is an interesting phenomena in itself, because not to everybody, it's not always noise. You know, it's like going to a rock concert. You know, some people think that's music. Other people will consider it noise. And so there are some issues when you start looking at what one person thinks and what another person thinks. What I have found over, and again, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but most of the regulatory issues that you see, whether it's city ordinances, township ordinances, county ordinances, industrial regulations, are all based on decibels. It's based on decibels. And again, it goes back EPA. And actually, EPA doesn't even have a regulatory requirement on that anymore. That was ended in the 80s, actually, and what took over, OSHA has regulations based on industrial noise, which is on that 85 decibels, and it came all about looking at when did hearing get impacted? When did we start having hearing loss? And that was at 85 to 90 decibels. And again, it was all measured on decibels. Frequency was not an issue. And so when OSHA came...
Hold up for a second there. Just okay. I want to, as you hit key points, to see if there's any disagreement in that. That okay. You made a comment that there's no EPA guideline on regulation, or noise regulation. So the EPA has just guidelines they put out there. So from the EPA, they don't expect any enforcement of that. Yeah. Is that fair? That's what I'd throw out to the group of right away. If there's something that you know right off the bat that might be flawed in that.
Well,
I'm not trying to shoot holes, but I am trying to shoot holes. No,
there is. And again, there is one. There's an EPA document that came out. It's called Information on Levels of Environmental Noise Requisites to Protect Public Health and Welfare with Adequate Margin of Safety. Okay. And there again,
yeah,
they.
Can you get your mic on there, too?
What that came out, commissioners, is that what EPA wanted to do is, since most regulatory issues were not necessarily an EPA issue, but they were going to municipalities and counties and whatever, that they wanted to kind of give them a format of what would be things that they would want to address in terms of noise. And there again, they talked about the document identifies a 24-hour exposure level of 70 decibels as a level of environmental noise.
No, but Darryl, what I'm trying to say is, and this is good, but let's just take one step here at a time. Should the EPA have what their guidelines are, is that something that most folks here agree that should be like a guiding tool, or is that something that the feds have some rule on and the state doesn't agree with it, or we think we could do more? Because it's the same thing. The feds will come out with something on air quality, and as a state we may fight it because we think something's different. And that's where I'd throw out to Randy and Julie and others that I think that becomes the beginning premise that the EPA has spent a lot of time on this. We either say we're going to work with that, or we say, no, we're going to do something stricter or less.
It's from my understanding, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what I understood from this document that it was a recommendation.
Okay, so they don't ever try to enforce anything.
Mm-mm. I don't think it's an enforcement. Patrick. Is that correct?
You could borrow Randy's mic if you want.
I did run across this earlier this morning. I think that based on the FERC looked at EPA guidelines and has adopted a rule, I believe, that they have a 55 decibel from compressor station.
Okay.
To the nearest receptor, like a residence and receptor.
So if the FERC adopts it, that's something this commission could consider down the road if we adopt that or don't adopt it. Which, have we ever done that to anybody's knowledge? Alana, I'm looking at you.
Not to my knowledge.
55. Right.
I would add that unless the feds mandate for some reason that a state do something, and that would entail questions of whether they're entitled to mandate that a state do something, then you would have to have a basis for whatever you decide to do, whether it's a rule based on evidence that you've gathered from other sources like FERC or EPA or OSHA, or in a case you would have to have it. So you have to have a basis for what you adopt. And if you use a basis that, say, FERC used, you'd want to say that it's relevant to North Dakota, and you'd have to convince yourself that it is and allow people to comment on that sort of thing.
Okay, and that's in the past, the wind turbine setbacks. We've never, commission previously has never picked a number because we wanted the ability that this might be appropriate at one point, 2000 might be appropriate somewhere else. We never wanted to box ourselves in because each case is different.
Right, and each case, though, you're gathering information on what the setback should be in that case, I believe.
But the science of noise, I mean, Darryl's got a lot of research there, too, but is there someone better to do noise research? Or maybe I should let you then, once we cleared this up, everybody's cool there, maybe then let you keep rolling again. You guys, Randy, Julie, you guys have any thoughts about that, to where, how we should look at that from the very beginning, noise? Because I have a viewpoint of one is, you know what, I'm comfortable with the EPA as a guideline, I'll deal with it case by case, I'm the good. Another thought, well, maybe we should require more of the companies to do things. I can go either way on that. But in the past, I've been more of an EPA guidelines. As long as the company tells me EPA guidelines they can meet, I'm okay with it.
I don't have a position yet.
Okay, fair enough. I'm trying to box them in early.
All right. I think one of the what's problematic about the EPA guidelines is that when these were enacted, they really didn't know the scope of some of the things that are coming to be at this time.
Okay.
And so those EPA guidelines are somewhat limited in their field of what they look at, even though they do address at some point they talk about frequency and stuff like that, but that's all they do. They never go beyond that and give you any solid feeling of what should or shouldn't be, you know.
And again, these guidelines that EPA has is at 55 decibels, but that's pretty much their focus, indoor, outdoor, or whatever. But I think what's interesting, you know, there aren't a lot of companies out there that are dealing with noise right now. There aren't a lot of noise experts. When it comes back down to it, everyone that I looked at came back to the company that was here earlier, you know, out of Littleton, Colorado. That was the only company, and every time I would check a different resource, it came back to them. Like I said, I ended up calling a lot of engineering companies, both from Fargo to here, and Caversley and Jackson was the only one that indicated that they had a person that they would declare as an expert in terms of noise. So to find somebody, commissioners, it was really challenging. There's a lot of research out there and a lot of comments dealing with noise pollution, which starts to look more at mitigating issues and noise, not so much in terms of decibel, but in terms of annoyance. As Commissioner Crispin was saying, is that when noise becomes an annoyance, it's not necessarily damaging to the ear, but it becomes an annoyance. Now, there's also been a lot of research that has been done that annoyance can cause medical issues as well, based on stress. And stress, and that can cause heart issues and all other sorts of issues that I've seen in a couple of studies that they were trying to deal with noise annoyance, okay? Not necessarily based on decibels or frequency, but just that it causes such stress in that person's life that it begins to become physically, has some physical ailments that seem to come from that. Are those conclusive? No. Those are all preliminary studies that have been done. There aren't a lot of studies. The only one real true study that I saw was one that was done in Egypt in dealing with water pump stations out of the Nile. And that's when I look at, I mean, I haven't read it thoroughly yet because I don't understand all the science behind it, but it's a pretty thick document on noise. And there were, again, complaints coming from the villages, you know, along the Nile that were concerned about not necessarily decibel noise, but frequency noise, you know, and they talk about low frequency and high frequency and how low frequency needs to be mitigated differently than high frequency, that the middle frequencies don't seem to have a big impact. You know, it's the variances in frequency that have. For example, low frequency actually can be mitigated by trees. In low frequency, they've been talking about shelters. Okay, and again, these are preliminary studies that have been done. But I thought that was interesting.
Sure, if I could just interject too, a question for Skip or whoever. We had experts in here a while ago that said that trees really don't do much to mitigate noise. And I was like, huh? I mean, I don't know, I was just in Minneapolis, and they've got all these sound barriers for interstate and all these things, and I didn't disagree with them. I just was really taken back. And curious your thoughts about that.
Well, I would agree with that.
Which part?
The trees don't mitigate
okay.
noise, not very well, especially traffic noise. They have very little effect on traffic noise whatsoever.
So why do we plant trees?
They do other good things?
Yeah. For the greater good, right?
One thing, there's just a whole host of issues on this thing. I don't know where we want to start or stop or
there are certain data dumping on us, because I'm curious to know what you because you're involved in this, and yeah. Daryl set it up really well, I think.
I just know, like I said, I'm not an expert. Can I make one more comment before I look? Because there's also been a lot of research that has been done, and Craig, you may be wrong, about how annoyance and certain noises impact livestock, wild animals. It impacts breeding and those type of things. That's based on high frequency, what I've read. Is that, am I correct in saying that?
Yep.
But I know there have been, again, keep in mind that there's not a lot of studies out. So it's not like we're comparing a lot of different things. This was one study that was done saying that there was impact on wildlife, livestock, on certain irritating noises that disrupts the natural habitat. Okay? So I found a study that was done on that. What else was I going to say on that? And again, it did talk. And remember, I visited with the people that helped generate the policies and the ordinances, both in Fargo, Bismarck, and Mandan. And they talk about how water impacts noise.
Let me ask you a question on that with Alana and anybody else. That one of the things with the wind setbacks that we did was we kind of had our commission guidelines. But if a political subdivision had their own rules on setbacks, we followed them, unless they were less restrictive than ours. So is this an issue that is better dealt with at the political subdivision level than having the Public Service Commission come out there with these things?
Well, I think in the talking just siting it for a moment, I think in the Siting Act, you do have to follow them.
Right.
It's the transmission line if you have a good reason to not follow the local ordinance. You can override it because of the transmission going from A to B.
We can make it less restrictive. We can make it more.
But yes, you can make it more restrictive. But, like, if there was some sort of a conflict, I think for a plant, you'd have to conform, like a wind farm. You'd have to conform to local. It's also it's possible. I mean, the noise of a transmission line, like pipeline with pump station noise, I mean, in theory, you could override a local ordinance there, but the next question would be, would you want to, given that that was probably never a consideration when the law was enacted, right, saying you could over, they're probably talking about where you're going to put it as opposed to how much noise it can make. But for siting, we did this morning, Daryl and I you're probably getting to this next, but okay. This, we talked to this Bob Burns. I was just kind of sent some emails out to people. I was thinking NRRI, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you ever contacted anybody at NRRI.
I did not have any. Did,
okay.
Have that.
But then I emailed Jan Beecher, and she mentioned Bob Burns, who used to be with NRRI, but now he's just with Ohio State. And he has done a lot of work on siting, and he has said that there's not a lot out there. There are some other states that have incorporated noise into their siting requirements, whether it's orders. But he has not been able to do any research or anything yet on that, although he would be a good source to try to gather that together in nationally, how many commissions or entities that deal with siting, what have they done with it? Of course, he probably needs to be paid, so therefore we have to talk about that at the end.
Well, we have,
but it's a source.
Yeah,
it is a source of kind of a centralized, because he teaches some NRRI courses on siting, and noise has not been one they've come up with yet, but he was familiar enough to know that he could gather together other states.
Just a thought, could we get maybe, I don't want to take all you guys' time, but we can meet together with us, but maybe if you Skip, you guys start talking a little bit more about what you might see as, okay, these are some concerns that I might have about noise going forward. These are some things that I'm seeing out there, just to get your perspective.
Yeah, I was just trying to decide how in-depth, how complicated I wanted to make this, how where I wanted to go with this as you were talking and stuff. And I think there's a couple things that are at issue here. And Randy was talking about the annoyance factor, and then we were talking about the compressor factor, and then the wind turbines and then that kind of thing. So really we have different sources of noise that cause different things to go on. And one thing to be clear on some of these studies and stuff that have been done on wind turbines and stuff, a lot of those studies are been done when they were downwind turbines. They have since changed that, and they're upwind turbines. And so the difference is the thumping. Mm. When the blade turns around, there used to be a post, so when the downwind would come, the wind would blow, and as that blade blew by the wind, the thing, you'd get a thump. You get that thumping. And so most of the turbines now are upwind. They face into the wind when they turn, when they go. But anyway, what we have is a couple things. Low-frequency noise is, at the best, hard to deal with. It's hard to measure. It's hard to mitigate. There's a couple different studies out there. One is out of Canada. I brought that along. It references one that was done in Oregon and one that was done in California, and they were talking about low frequency, how to measure low frequencies and that kind of stuff. And one of the things that we see that is the best way to go about measuring low frequency is really a combination of a couple approaches. To be honest, there is no good way, but there's a way that has got some studies behind it that show that it is a valuable tool. And that's when you take and monitor the site, and you monitor it at two levels, or actually three. You monitor it for an A-weighted level, a decibel reading of A-weighted level. And an A-weighted decibel level is really a combination of the different frequencies that are your ear responds to, and it gives it a weighting. But the problem with the A-weighted level is it kind of disregards the low frequencies, and it kind of disregards the high frequencies. So there's a tendency for it to be kind of middle of the road. The other portion that you want to do is call a C-weighted rating. And C-weighted rating has a tendency to take into account the low frequency noise at the 16 decibels, at the 30 decibel or kilohertz level. So what then happens is you subtract one from the other. You subtract the A-weighted from the C-weighted, and you will get a decibel reading that shows whether there's something going on at the lower spectrum of the frequency and the low frequency noise levels. And so if that is subject, and when you talk about regulations and how to approach this, in my mind this would be one way that I would look at it. I would do an initial screening, so to speak, where you make these two comparisons, and if it looks like there's something going on at these lower frequencies, then you would probably want to do a spectrum analysis to figure out just exactly where this is coming from at these low frequencies. And so then...
What's the risk of low frequency exposure?
I don't think that's really been very well documented, to be honest.
So it's an annoyance, not a...
Well, there are some people that are hypersensitive to it, and some people, you know, it doesn't bother. Well, okay, a good example of this, and this is one of my favorite ones, is you're standing on a street corner, and all of a sudden you hear a boom, 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 and you look around, you don't see anything.
You're nervous.
Yeah, you're a little nervous. Pretty soon this really dark car drives by.
Yeah, sure.
It's got the back seat bass just pounding. And then it goes off that way, and then you hear it go away. But you can hear it for a long ways.
Sure.
And that's something to kind of think about when we talk about frequencies. When you look at the...
Can you give us some examples? Like, what is a low frequency versus high frequency? Just so we can relate it to something that we've heard.
on a guitar. There's six strings. The high string is high frequency. The low string is a low frequency. And it's the rate at which that vibrates. Can I use that board?
Absolutely, if you can.
It's got to be turned on.
Oh,
hold on. Okay. That's,
that's all right.
No.
Oh, it's a fancy smart board. It's not a...
We don't just have a chalk.
Oh, I got several
in my office.
It's
not smart enough to turn itself on.
Whiteboard.
I'll let you near that with a pen.
But,
start drawing it.
Oh, that, yeah.
I just wanted to make a simple diagram, basically, kind of explain this a little bit.
Is that on or...
The green light
is on. The projector's got to be on. Scott's going to be in a second. He knows how to turn it on.
I had to use one of these. I have no idea. It's on. Oh.
He's coming in. He's on a call right now. So.
Oh.
Give him a second.
Do you want a sheet of paper?
There he is.
So, Skip, when you're talking decibel, like, that's what frequency is 55 decibel at?
It's not really out of frequency.
Nothing at all. No. It's a completely measured, so there's the completely...
It's a measurement of the loudness of the impact.
Okay.
We have to have
it. It won't come through on the internet or on the recording.
So I got to hold that?
Yeah, hold it and draw.
Okay.
So Skip, decibel frequency, what's the correlation again between the two, if there's any?
There is a correlation. There are basically the human ear can hear frequencies from about 20 hertz on up to 200,000 hertz.
Okay.
Okay. So they are broken down into octaves, so to speak. You have a 31.5 octave. You have a 62 octave, and it keeps doubling like that. And these octaves are the tones that we can hear.
And that's where dogs can hear things at much higher frequencies than we can.
Exactly.
What's the human band of frequencies?
The human band of frequencies is right around 20 hertz to about 200,000 hertz.
Okay. And as you get older, that band gets smaller?
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially the... the higher end band. So,
and to your knowledge, is there any regulation on frequency that you're aware of?
Well, frequency, no, but frequency plays a part in determining the decibel levels.
And that's what you're saying—the over/under numbers before and all that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If that makes.
Yep. Sense. Absolutely. All right.
Can I just draw on that, or?
All right.
Never used one either, actually.
So basically what we have, let me see how this is going to go. Basically what we have here when we talk about sound is basically, this is weird. We got the amplitude, in other words, the force of the sound. And that's on the y-axis. Then we've got duration, which is on the x-axis, and goes like that. So if you have a sound that comes out, it creates waves, like so. And sound waves, really what they're doing is moving particles in the air back and forth. And these particles are always trying to find a place to rest, to be where they... So they're not moving. But as we talk or as we do things, we force them particles to move. Now those particles can move at different frequencies or speeds or amplitude over time. So like a high-pitched sound with high frequency, these compressions and relaxations will be closer together. So that's where you get the high pitch. At low frequency, these things are further apart, like so.
Now, the interesting thing about this, if you were to measure this low-frequency line to a given point and measure the high-frequency line to a given point, this would drag out further than this one. I guess what I'm trying to say is that low frequency will go further longer than a high frequency. That's why it's so difficult to mitigate low frequency waves. They go through walls, they go through trees, they can go through water, they can just thump their way through things.
You jumped to my next question. So if you put a tree in the middle of that wave or a concrete wall,
you're going to disrupt it, true. But if you are right on the other side of that wall, and that's why low frequencies in houses, that's why you get these complaints of people in houses, they feel it inside the house.
Sure.
Because the walls are doing that.
Okay. Mm.
And you've all felt the car drive by.
Yeah, just a comment. As I noticed, as going through the web, how many companies are out there that are developing noise panels or ceiling panels or floors? I mean, there's just, and is that, I don't know where that all is coming from, but I'm assuming that is coming from noise concerns as well.
If you're going to try and mitigate low-frequency noise, the best place to do it is at the absolute source. Before it gets into what they call the free area, where it can just roll.
And there have been a lot of studies that have been done that says you have to deal with the source, and whether it's a machine or whatever it is, have to reduce the noise coming from that machine, whether it's new oil processing things that go on with a bunch of stuff. So
And high-pitched noise, high-frequency noises, they are easy to dampen. They're easy to break up. Low pitch is not so easy to break up.
Hearing damage, is that more prone to, I know, like 85 decibels, let's say, that's hearing damage, we say. If it's 85 decibels, and I might be saying this all wrong, at a high pitch, high frequency, or low frequency, does that matter at all? Because you said the correlation. I'm still trying to get my head around that.
Yeah. It for low frequency you're not that doesn't matter, but in this decibel is the power level at which this is coming through. If back to this car thing again, if you were to stand there, you can hear that low frequency car coming. It doesn't hurt your ears. You can hear it when it's right beside you. And it's probably clocking 65, 75 decibels right beside you. And that really doesn't hurt your ears. Because the vibration is the sound waves are so far apart.
So you take a high saw, louder than heck.
Yeah. That's damaging your ears.
Because of the
pitch. The frequency is very high, very intense, very quick.
So there is, of course, so if we're going to look at something, the risk factor for high-pitched sounds is a lot more than low-pitched sounds.
It is. That's true. It is. But again, high-pitched sounds are easier to deal with.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing. The low-pitched sounds is the annoyance factor. It causes disrupted sleep, and some people are way more sensitive to it than others, and that's where the problems come in. But we all have a friend in distance, because it doesn't matter whether it's high pitch or low pitch, if you've got distance, you're going to be able to mitigate a great deal of that intrusion. A lot of the studies that I've seen anyway, where low pitch was coming into play and people were complaining, they were within 900 to 1,000 feet of something. They were relatively close to something. But then again, you know, that's, I don't know. It really depends a little bit on the person that's dealing
is
with
it. Is it drop-off for these frequencies where, like, it's like a rifle shell. First 200 meters, it's flat. Mm-hmm. You get 250, it just drops. Mm-hmm. Or does it stay all the way till the end?
It's kind of like this. The law.
Like an arch.
Yeah. Okay. It's like a rifle, so to speak. It has the law's inverse squared law. So as the noise is projected out away from the source into the free space, it will, over time, every time it moves another foot, it's got to move more molecules. And every time it moves more molecules, it dissipates energy. Mm-hmm. And so over time and distance, that energy continues to dissipate until there is no effect.
So how much would atmospheric conditions affect this?
It does, a lot.
So, like a what if? The best and worst scenario is to transmit noise.
The worst scenario to transmit noise is dry air. It doesn't go
worst
through.
Worst being it doesn't transmit very well, or it transmits so far it bugs everything?
No, it doesn't. Dry air does not transmit noise very well. Humid air does. Water, better.
What about cold? Because, you know, I know about cold.
And, well, dry air. See, when you've got noise coming at you, and it goes on a plane system, when noise comes at you and the ground is warm, noise has a tendency to bend up. When the ground is cold, it has a tendency to bend down.
So go farther.
Yep. And then, of course, when you got a hard surface, then you get refraction, and so you get this bouncing of noise all over the place. Water, good example. You can hear people on the lake for miles. You know. But so anyway, that's kind of the some of the physics behind it anyway. But as far as looking at a way to, I don't know, to test or to evaluate whether something is an annoyance or a problem, I still think I go back to what I said before, is to do an initial screening. And if it appears that the low end of the spectrum is going to be impacted based on the subtraction, and you will find that out in there, that then you should probably do an acoustic analysis or a spectrum analysis and find out exactly where things are, and then it's a lot easier to pinpoint.
Is that expensive? I don't know what that is.
Can be. It's not the cheapest thing in the world, no.
Who does it?
I do.
What do you, how? Like,
well, we have instruments that we go out and monitor sites and stuff like that. I don't know if you're familiar with the gas turbine out here in Mandan. I did the noise modeling for that gas turbine. And we've done some other pumps and different things like that. But,
And I guess part of the reason it's pricey is because you're monitoring over 24-hour periods, right?
Yeah.
My only question I have, again, I'm sorry, I don't mean, but when you do all this measuring, what does it mean? I mean, because if it's challenging to mitigate, well, so you know it,
What do you do with it then?
Well,
you predict the outcome before you build the project.
Exactly.
But you have to do it beforehand.
Well, you know, like NEPA. NEPA goes through, and you can do anything under NEPA, but you know what the outcome is. So you make a prediction of the outcome. But if you know this is going to happen, then this is, you can predict what impact the people there is. And that's a powerful tool, because then you know that you're going to have irritation of these people, or you know you're going to have chemicals in the water. What you don't want to do is build a project and you predict something and it's way off.
And the other thing too is that manufacturers know what the power level of their equipment is.
But Daryl's point though, it's all good, but there still has to be some number that we would say is above or below this or something.
Yeah.
To,
Yeah.
You have a number of six, but if you don't have a rule that says six is okay,
yeah.
What's the point of doing it?
You know, that's probably a little beyond
sure.
what I would want to say, but I have a feeling of what I would do, but that's the
For the, yeah, for the commission to this point has always used the EPA guideline as our guideline, and they'll model whether it's a wind or pipeline or whatever, they'll model, and they'll come in with a model and sound studies that say they're well below this level at all the different points, and they'll show different factors. And then we've had cases where then someone will come back in and question that, and then the data will be taken care of. So that's been the guideline before, is EPA guidelines have been a quasi, that's what we kind of use. But it doesn't mean we have to use them at all. Or we couldn't use something different. And that's kind of what we're trying to figure out here is if we should or shouldn't do anything else.
Your new guidelines that came out first for wind turbines, did I read it correctly and it said that there's a 50 decibel limit on that for residents? Or am I mistaken?
I don't.
Maybe that was draft guidelines.
I don't think we have any guidelines hard and fast in any of that. Alana can jump in here, but.
We have new siting rules that. We're trying to remember what they said because they just took effect yesterday.
The first is when I saw them online, and I thought it said 50 dB out of residence for wind generation facility, in which case there is already published.
Well, I think that's the – I think we have – well, speaking for me, I feel comfortable we got good guidelines about decibels. But it's this whole frequency discussion. And to me, maybe mitigation. I mean, what can you do – that we should maybe be looking at. What does work? Nothing?
Well, no. There's things that work. There's things that work. And that has to do when mm-hmm. that has to do when you know the and I don't know if I'm this is appropriate or not to talk about the.
As long as you don't bias us on a case that's in front of us.
I mean, the I guess the Heska station over here, you know.
We voted on that already. So
yeah, so we're good. Okay. But anyway, one of the things was that they sent to me what they were going to use for equipment. I go to GE and I say, okay, what are your sound power levels at the source? What are these sound power levels at these different decibel reading or frequency readings at the source? So we take all these frequencies of all these components that are involved in that, and we go, whoa, wait a minute here, we've got some noise going on here that is above, it's not above the threshold of the immediate zoned area, but it becomes above the threshold as away from it. So it's an impact. So what we do is we turn around and we go back to the manufacturer and we say, okay, we need to, this component is fine, we're okay with this, what it's, the noise that it's emitting. This component is not. What can we do to drop this level? We have to drop the power level of this component to this in order to meet these numbers on the outside. And they go, yeah, we can do that. We can do this and this. And I go, okay. So then we reevaluate it and rerun it again, and we come up with what we think is a buildable facility that's going to stay within the Mandan guidelines.
Of decibels.
Of decibels.
But if some political subdivision wanted to make a guideline on frequency, low frequency, they could pass something that could not engineer towards, so the alternative would be just don't build it.
They could possibly engineer toward it. It would be difficult.
So that's the danger you'd offer up in getting too much regulation on certain types of frequencies.
So if you were to regulate frequencies, do you have to have a lower decibel for lower frequency? Is that
not necessarily?
Or is there how are the two related?
I think
decibels and frequencies.
For frequencies between the 200 hertz and the or 20 hertz and the 200 hertz, I think normally speaking, the accepted level is about 60-65 decibels.
Oh.
Is that what's in like Mandan and Bismarck?
Mandan and Bismarck, they talk just decibels in general as being a noise regulation.
this low frequency stuff that is coming out is recommendations from people that have been studying this, and a lot has been done in Europe, in Denmark, and in those areas where they got a lot of wind turbines, a lot of complaints about low frequency noise, and so this is where they're looking into this, and this is one of the things that they're finding, is that when you compare this A and C rating together, when we start to get that spread in the frequencies and in the decibel levels, that's when the complaints and the annoyances start the highest, become noticeable. So what they've kind of done is done a little bit of sociology along with a little bit of science. Where are the people complaining? At what level? And so they're kind of looking at that, and then they come back and say, okay, if we do this, we can drop that. And so one of the things they're saying is that these low frequency numbers, you know, the 16s, the 32s, and the frequency levels need to be under that 60 decibels.
Mm. Like how far under?
Well, I don't know.
60 would be the top.
Yeah, the more the better.
Less than 60.
Yeah, the more the better. That's the way I understand this.
Can you take sound to where, like, when you do with parts per million of mercury in water, they come out with the number that says that if the level is 6 parts per million, the average person is not going to have any effects on that. But you're always going to have somebody that is affected by that level. But you have a methodology that they figure out what you can put into the water based on health effects. And the average person, it seems like sound, you're always going to have somebody that say that they're going to be affected.
Yeah, there's always going to be
somebody. But is there a norm? When they do these studies, is it based on a normal population, if you will?
That's what they try to shoot for, yeah. They take a group of people. And
but there's always going to be somebody, just like everything else, that...
Yeah, that's just not going to work. And you're not going to make everybody happy. That's just not going to be.
Is it harder to control one noise versus when you're talking about the gas turbine in Mandan with lots of noises? It seems like when I look at your little waves here, seems like if you had multiple noises, some of those waves would be disrupted from other noises. Is that true?
That's how you end up with dBs, decibels, because it's a combination of this whole spectrum of frequencies interacting to your ear and to these monitors, and that's electromagnetic reaction.
Okay.
Is that not what I'm going for here?
Okay. I'm just wondering, if you have two noises, is there a possibility, let's say they're both facing each other, that the waves are...
I wouldn't want to stand between them.
You wouldn't, but if you're trying to stop them from going long distance, would that minimize that? Would that disrupt the waves? You see what I'm asking.
Yeah, to a degree it's going to, but at the same time when you take two noise sources and put them together, your amplification and your duration are going to be higher.
Yep.
So it's going to be, you may disrupt some of it, and you may disrupt maybe the higher end of it or something.
I think your answer then is no. one noise versus a bunch.
Yeah, it's hard to, yeah.
Skip, can you, let's say you have a facility that was given a noise value of something by the commission, and all of a sudden there's a complaint that it's not meeting that noise value. And I'm not talking the pipeline case. I'm talking more of in a city.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the project has been probably doing the same amount of noise as always, but you add a train station next door and a rock club next door and Julie's kids are playing in the backyard. that then we get a complaint that says, well, they've no longer meet the criteria, that we could really go back and say that, no, it's not the company. We can we had a case where they said they could identify a wolf howling as a noise, and seemed like a stretch, but I was listening. I mean, can you break your noise values down to that? To kind of what Mike is saying is where the project is surrounded by other things, and now the project itself maybe, when you measure there, it's well above what it's supposed to be, but it has nothing to do with what the project may have done. And it may be the project changed, but...
So we're talking cumulative effects.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if that station, if that facility was there prior to the rest of the things going on, I don't know how you can come back at that station or that facility and say you're now too noisy, unless they've done something to increase whatever they're doing. You know, But if you can isolate those noises out?
Hypothetically, we file an order that says it'll not exceed 50 decibels. That's what the order says. 10 years from now, that number has increased. The city has grown. Somebody files a complaint against us and says, this company is violating its order because now if you measure it here where they said it would always be 50, it's 65. So there's a case that they can make. So we would have to be able to show a good record as to how that has not been because of their actions.
Well, what we
could take your approach and say, well, of course, nothing's changed.
What we can do is we can do a temporal model. Okay. So in that model, what we would do is we would go on a time frame basis. What is here in 1960? What is here in 1965, 1970? And we just keep adding to that model until we find out at which level. You know, we know when these buildings are built. We know when this has happened. We know when that happens. So we can add that in a temporal sort of keep adding into that, and we can model that.
So you can model then if the effects of wind in a noise model?
Some.
Yeah. See, there's another problem. The project itself may be below the threshold. You put in a big windstorm now and again, now that it exceeded the value. Yeah. And that's the rubber meets the road in some of these things we're trying to deal
with. Yeah, that'd be true. You can add wind to the model, but can you account for all of it all the time? I don't know. Because wind goes, you know, I was out in the Badlands in Theodore Roosevelt Park doing a noise study. It was 50 decibels out there. There was nothing going on, and it was 50 decibels. It was noisy. But it's all what they consider ambient noise. Trees are rustling, the wind was blowing, you know, all this stuff was going on out there, and that's ambient noise. So is it noise or is it sound?
But if someone said that, no, it's not ambient noise, that's the noise of all that truck and oil well traffic right on the other side of the hill that you can't see, can you set something up and distinguish between the two?
You can.
And prove one side right or wrong?
You can if you know, if you want to take your analysis, put it out on paper, and start cutting it up. We know that that truck creates this level at this frequency. This is where the truck is. Mm-hmm. This is where the oil well is. We can do that. And we can pull those out of that time frame of recordings. And I don't know what it would do at that point other than the fact that you could isolate it out.
And how do you do that? By going right by where the truck operates and measuring it and then calculating how loud it would be over on
you would have to know that number to pull it out of there. That same study I did in the park. It was kind of interesting to see because we recorded the sound. Not only did we have a noise meter there for 24 hours, but we also recorded what the noise meter was hearing. And it was interesting when the coyotes let out, mm-hmm. and that meter would jump like that. Truck, kind of the same thing, but over a period of 24 hours. That little bleep in there has little or no effect on the overall level.
Does it make sense to have different decibel regulations for different frequencies, or is it better to have one kind of overall cumulative? So like say you have 50 cumulative versus 60 for low frequencies.
Yeah, I think it'd be hard-pressed to just isolate it down to one. I think you need to qualify how you're arriving at that decibel rating for that area or for that whatever you're trying to, you know, for that facility or whatever you want to look at. If you're going to say that
this kind of facility should not have a decibel reading of over 70 decibels. What's that mean? What does that 70 decibels mean? Does it mean an A-weighted average? Does it mean C-weighted? What does that mean? So if you go back and say that 70 decibels means this, then I think that works.
So what's this? Give me an example.
Well, it's kind of like it's kind of like what I was saying. If we take that 70 decibels means that you've taken, and I go back to this low frequency thing again, that if you take an A-weighted average over time and a C-weighted average over time and you subtract those out, you end up with this. Mm. And that's acceptable. Because we know that 60 decibels is, we can sit here in your TV, it's in your living room, it's 60 decibels in there. Mm. And that's acceptable. 80, probably not so much. So if you can do that and qualify how you arrive or how you're saying this needs to be this and for what reason, then I think you're okay with decibels. I would avoid the frequency thing.
If the TV is got your favorite singer on it at 50 decibels, you might find that pleasing, and if the kids are over on the old-fashioned chalkboard with their fingernails on it, at the same levels, same decibel level, it would be not so pleasing. So isn't that the argument for a different tolerance at different frequencies?
But frequencies are true. That's a little true. But frequencies are still not an isolated frequency. You don't have just 31 hertz. You don't have just that. You don't have just 32. You don't have just 100. You have all these things going on. And you have to have a way to judge that. You scratch your fingernails on the wall, that hertz is high. And it's annoying, and it's probably painful for me. but at the same time, that's an isolated incident. But you have to add all these things together.
It's hard to separate these and get readings. Is that what you're saying? Like, you can how get would you ever regulate it? Because
you can get readings on all these different hertz. I mean, you can get these frequency readings. That's
if they're all taken at the same time. So yeah. All these things are occurring at the same time. You can say, "Oh,
yeah." There's such and such a level of, maybe there's 45 dB of 16 hertz. Maybe there's 40 dB of 32 hertz. Maybe there's so many dB of this hertz, so on. Right down the whole spectrum of the hearing frequency, but we have to take those together and take those into account because they interact on each other. This stuff all works together. It's not just one isolated frequency out there. When you're looking at pumps or you're looking at turbines, there's a lot more going on than just one squeaky wheel. You know, there's a whole host of things taking place.
Mm-hmm. So tell us again why you wouldn't get into the regulating of frequency or setting different levels for different frequencies.
Because that's why. Because it's hard to isolate them. Or not hard to isolate them, but it's... What...
Hard to say who's to blame.
Yeah, what would you do with it? I mean, I don't know.
Here's my answer to that. I don't know where you live, but if there was going to be whichever community you live in going to allow an industrial site within earshot of your home, if it's just a kind of a pleasant buzz at 50 decibels, you probably don't care. But you just didn't react very well to the fingernail on the chalkboard deal idea. So if whatever they're going to have at that industrial site makes that noise all day long at 50 decibels, I'm guessing that then you wouldn't like having that area zone for industrial.
It'd be higher than 50 decibels, my guess.
You're saying it'll trigger because of that.
Yeah,
If you're saying that facility is going to have like a fingernail on the chalkboard
noise constantly.
Yeah, it's going to be way higher than 50 decibels. You'll probably be clocking around 85 and maybe 90 for that.
You have one bad actor making a high decibel rating at a low frequency or whatever it is, it's going to ruin the frequency rating for, or the decibel rating for all of it. It's going to raise it all. So you'd be above
to a certain degree, yes. That's why when I go back to, when I talk about these A-weighted averages, that's why when we start talking frequencies, it's not the best way. If you're looking at allowing or how to judge some of this stuff, just an A-weighted average is not the way to do it, because it disregards the high and the low to get this average.
Does anyone know if that's what we're doing?
I don't know the answer to that, but if something is 85 decibels, then isn't there some distance away from that where it is 50?
Yes.
And then a little more distance and it's 40?
Yes.
Okay, so if that's your house, you're not very happy with that either, are you?
Well, it's going to be annoying.
We usually put the orders, we say that it cannot exceed EPA value at the receptors. So we do define... We say the point.
The nearest receptor.
To the nearest receptor is what we'll put in there. So if it doesn't meet at the nearest receptor, you wouldn't think it would meet it farther away. But yeah, we've had to qualify with where is that going to be measured at. Yeah. And the problem would be if when you sight it, the receptor is here, and that's fine. And then since that time, three more receptors have moved in closer to that facility.
Then you get problems.
That's the challenges we can face. Pat, you were going to.
Well, surely you mentioned that from 20 hertz to 200 hertz, which is a low frequency, that the level should be less than 60 to 65 decibel.
Roughly, yeah.
And are you talking about A-weighted?
Well.
And then the second part of my question is, do we have a number for other frequency ranges?
Yes. And yes.
Yes and yeah. Okay. Good.
But the other ones don't matter because they really don't come into play. The middle frequencies are not a big deal. It's only really the high frequencies that we care about. But again, they're a combination of many things that are creating these, and you can isolate those out and mitigate just the high frequencies. That's true, but there are other things that come into play, and I don't know if you want to get into separating out all these different frequencies and all these different mitigation measures for all these different things. I don't know. But.
Skip, would it help to we do a lot of noise modeling, or Skip does a lot of noise modeling for under Fed highway regulations, which Fed Highway already has regulations in place. Would it any of that type of stuff be of any benefit to how you model that and what they look for levels on roadway expansions, anything like that, levels that they find acceptable?
The difference between that and what we're doing here is that the highway is a movable noise piece. That's moving. Here we're talking with fixed noise.
Okay.
And really, we can model a combination of both. We can take moving noise and fixed noise into a model and figure out what's going on.
It might be interesting, though, if you could just point us to where those numbers are at. So you're saying for the highway, when the highway department goes through, they've got to make sure that it's, do they use more than 55 decibels?
Well, we have to stay below 65 decibels at, or 66, I believe it is. The DOT has just kind of modified their regulations or guidance here just lately. But anyway, at any receptor. So when we go out and monitor these sites, we create a baseline. So, for example, we go out... by Watford City or someplace out there is one that I'm thinking about in general, is that we're working on a bypass out there.
Sure.
And guess what? Where we're going to put that bypass, nobody lives.
No.
No. So when we go out there, well, no, we already changed it once because an oil well went in, so we had to go around it. But when we went out to monitor these sites, we're getting readings of 45, 50. Okay, so we bring this back in, and now we bring our road down through there, and we're putting 18,000 vehicles a day through there. Guess what happens? You got huge impacts. And so that's a case where, you know, we have to figure out how to mitigate for that. And we can. And we can build noise walls. But they're long, they're extensive, they're tall, and they're expensive.
But do they work?
They work.
Okay, so noise walls work. I thought stuff didn't work for frequencies. For decibels, it does.
Low frequencies in and of themselves are hard to contain. We're talking moving traffic.
Okay, that's the point, though. Okay, yeah. I see your difference then.
So
that's the difference then.
Well, it's to a point. It is the difference.
Okay.
It is the difference.
It is a difference.
Yeah. You don't have near the... You do have some of the lower frequencies in traffic movement, but nothing like what we were talking about there. So anyway...
That's a point to make. If someone says, why can't you just put up a wall and make it like the highway department does? Say, well, it's a different kind of noise. There's different things involved.
And there is.
It's an intermittent source. It's okay.
And can you stop it? Yeah, you get enough thick enough wall, tall enough wall, you can do about anything, I think. But is it feasible? Is it reasonable?
Does a wall just stop the noise?
It refracts it.
Or does it just bounce it over somewhere else?
When we design noise barriers for the highway, we have to stay within the right of way. So that right of way isn't a limiting factor. But we go along, we get out to the outside edge of the right-of-way, and so we know that our road is this high, and you got a truck that's 13 feet higher than that. Mm-hmm. Right away, your wall is going to have to be a minimum of 13 feet to mitigate that noise. So the noise from that truck comes over, hits that wall, some of it hits here, bounces up, some of it hits, bounces down. The object of the game is to get the noise to travel the furthest distance. Because the further you can make noise travel, the less impact it's going to have. So the wall is essentially doing that. You're making it travel greater distances. Plus, you're initially shielding what's in the immediate forefront of above the threshold of noise, above that 65 decibels.
And the hook
that wall needs to, if we build a wall, that needs to drop that noise level behind that wall to 55 decibels. I can't just drop it back to where it was. If you're going to build that wall, you've got to build it so it drops it back to 55 decibels.
Or you lose your highway funding.
Yeah.
Well, no, but I mean, that's the hook they have. That's it's
yeah. But we also have a reasonable and feasible line in there. And, you know, it doesn't pay to build an 18-foot tall wall that's 3 miles long out in Watford City.
Yeah.
There's one guy out there. I mean, it's not that I don't care about him, but you're spending millions of dollars to put up this wall. And that's not feasible. It's not reasonable. And so there are, even in Fed guidelines, there is that reasonableness and feasibleness of building some of these mitigation things.
So do you think 50 is too low for us? We should be 65 to tie in with the Federal Highway Department?
Well,
a decision for us to make, but
yeah.
But I mean, they've settled in that number for a reason.
Yeah. It seems to be the standard that it's acceptable.
How much has that evolved over time?
Go ahead. Is it because it's moving noise and that's different?
Noise is noise in some respects, but.
But your point is
it's more intensity. Like, yeah, it's more white noise versus.
Yeah, and so.
More industrial sounds.
I know that when you get out into a residential area, you really should be looking at 50 decibels.
No, Julie, your point is right on. It's a different kind of noise.
So.
You get used to cars going by in the highway.
I was just going to say, I was read something about that they're recommending in the rural area 50 or less.
Yeah.
In decibels. I mean, I was just reading something. I don't remember where it was, but I remember.
All right. Well, we've been going about an hour 10. Julie or Andy, you guys got anything else that we should? I mean, I think let me finish that question first. We want to cover today?
Well, I guess I'm just curious whether there's a short answer to this or whether it's unanswerable or whether there's something that you could provide us. But if something were going in that you was going to impact your home and you didn't know what the frequency was going to be, you didn't know what the noise is going to be, you just know it's going to be some type of activity, what would you expect your community leaders to put on them for a limit above which point they have to do something to stop it, and below which point you're willing, you know, you're comfortable that you haven't been damaged by?
Yeah. I live in a farm a long ways from anything. My nearest neighbor is 2 miles away. It's pretty quiet out there.
But I bet you want to keep it that way, too.
Well, the geese are pretty noisy. But but anyway, you know, I think to respond to that, a lot has to do with your expectations. If I lived in town and I lived, trying to get, where am I here? And if I lived a block away from 94, my expectations are different than if I lived 20 miles north of town.
I think a lot of what we do here, though, has to do with people exactly like yourself. Now, something is going to come past your home. And what do we do to...
Okay, so are they going to redo?
Your life isn't disrupted.
If I live 2 blocks north on 94 here, are they going to redo 94 and make a 6-lane? You know.
When you live in the rural area.
Oh, in the rural area. Well, definitely, you're going to want to maintain a quality of life. That's I wouldn't argue with that a bit. You're going to want that to be maximum in my book would be 60. To be honest with you.
I guess I look at it from the standpoint of, if the person who lives in the conditions here is acceptable to them, is it not acceptable to somebody else in some other area as well, though? If 60 decibels is something that's acceptable from Fed Highway standpoint when they go to a 6-lane interstate for the people who live in town, and does the person who lives in a rural area, I also live outside of town, so I don't deal with a whole lot of traffic noise, but then is it also... Should I have different expectations that, you know, that I shouldn't have to listen to 60 decibels? That's a question. I don't know. I don't know who answers that. But, you know, if the person in town can listen to 60 decibels in their house or their residence, then is the rural person not able to listen to 60 decibels?
But it's a choice that they made not to have to deal with that type of noise. So I understand.
But the decibels would be all you'd really be concerned. You wouldn't be concerned about with what noise, what's causing that noise, or what it sounds.
Oh
like.
Yeah, I would. I would personally.
Because how do you regulate it? That's what we're trying to.
That's I know. I understand that, and I don't know what the easy answer for you is. Mm-hmm. To be honest, you can regulate it by defining what's acceptable, and how you term or how you arrive at that acceptability. And if you do that, you can make good regulations. I don't know how else to say it.
I think the challenge is that whatever the number might be, if you're at 20 decibels in the average night now, whether it's 30, 40, 50, or 60, your life has changed.
Yeah, it's something's changed.
And trying to figure out what's the best number and being able to justify that to everyone, because some people will never be happy. And
no.
But it's we want to do the right stuff.
And I agree with Randy. If something came in by my farm down there, I would not be very happy about it. I can be honest about that.
Can you do this A-weighted level minus C-weighted level in a model ahead of time before something is built?
Can you come up with?
Yeah. If we know what the manufacturing standards of that facility is, we can. We have to know those numbers. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't matter. The model is very, other than the algorithm that go into it, the model is pretty simple. Over time and space, noise goes away.
And you went to school for that?
Me?
Yeah.
No.
No, I mean, like, but you're right, it's a common sense stuff, right? I'm with you. The closer you are to stuff, the louder it's going to be.
Yeah.
And the mitigation, and that's the challenge we're facing, I think, is that trying to predict, I think, is a big thing. Is that if we do predict something and it's wrong, trying to mitigate stuff is very challenging.
If you try to mitigate after the fact, that's tough and expensive. To retrofit something facility or something else after the fact is very expensive.
Is it pretty common then for the manufacturers?
Oh, they have to, yeah. OSHA.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know. Because we've had orders with wind turbines. We weren't quite sure what the turbine was going to be.
They
haven't selected it because the ability of turbines, but we put things in the order that said it cannot exceed this amount. We don't care what you build, what you use, but whatever you use has to be below this level.
Yeah.
But that's a different scenario, I guess, than building a pipeline or a gas plant.
Yeah. But, you know, wind turbines, what I've found that wind turbines, for the most part, you're really pretty safe at 1,500 feet away. Things are pretty good.
Yep. And that's what we've settled in on our numbers, pretty solid on that.
Because all the curve data that I've run, by the time you get up around 800-900 feet, it's that noise level is dropped.
But we did have some serious concerns with people that had dog sleds, literally, and they had dog sleds and they were a couple miles away from the wind farm and their dogs complained.
I'm sure the dogs probably would have.
Well, it was a really tough issue, and we chose to not that did not affect human impact, but it definitely changed their lifestyle.
I can understand that.
It absolutely did.
Dogs are way more sensitive.
And it was a very heated, contentious hearing. And at the end of the day, we had to make decisions. And at the end of the day, there was upset people. But at least the impact was known before the project was built. It was no surprises.
Yeah.
And you knew what the impact was coming.
Yeah.
This formula you've described, this is different, I'm assuming, and I'm hoping that Jerry or Patrick can speak to this. This is different than the formula that sound expert described to us, where he took like day and night and there was like DCB. And do you remember that?
Yeah, we have not talked about that yet today. We have a little bit referred to it.
There's two decibels, DCB and
an LDC.
Oh, yeah, that.
An LEQ really is an A-weighted average.
Okay.
Basically, it's over time. It's the average sound over time, you know, and equivalent.
All right. So that's what the standard we've been using, I believe, right?
Yeah, it differs between day and night.
It does, because the regulations differ between day and night.
The EPA guidelines have different numbers for day and night.
Yeah. And so you can set up your monitoring to monitor for either a nighttime scenario or a daytime scenario.
And there's an equivalency between numbers. You can look at a 46 dB equivalent to a 56
daytime.
Daytime.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So I guess a little confusing too.
But in the long run of things, if you don't do a good job of monitoring, that equivalency could be.
One other thing I think we should just mention. Bring up.
We've been talking about frequency of sound so far as a tone, up and down, like low frequency, high frequency, right? But there's also a frequency of occurrence. Foom, 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 foom. And that has been a big deal with the wind generators. There have been studies out there that say that people's heart rates will follow those frequencies of occurrences and things like that. And none of this is proven, but... just another issue to throw into it. How fast is the drum beating?
I think some of that comes from the variation between an upwind versus downwind.
Just There's always a way to mitigate completely if you shut the project off.
Yeah.
That's the only way, right? Potentially. I don't think we want to get there.
And they're doing some pretty good acoustics inside the what are they called, the Newells?
Nacelle.
Yeah. Up in, they're doing some pretty good acoustics up in there now. They're getting these things to be fairly quiet.
All right, good. Okay. Julian, come on. Randy?
Not at this point.
I'll go around one more time, Patrick.
Well, I think when Julie was asking about the formula, I think the formula that you're talking about is kind of an after-the-fact formula that was used to measure and mm-hmm. analyze the noise. But the other formula is the formula that you use when you have the manufacturer's specifications and you predict what the noise is going to be. I think that's a different formula. And I'm more interested in that part of it. The company comes in with a proposal, and you look at that before you okay the project. Make sure that
Do we do that now?
Well, I think companies like MDU, when they did their gas plant, they said they had done some studies. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they started with manufacturer's specs or not.
We started with manufacturer's.
You did.
Specs,
yeah. Okay, so that's a company that did that, and I think that's a good way to.
Well, they
did you do the A and the C and all that.
Didn't have to there, because that was a high frequency thing.
But I think
but
most
you can
of
actually chart. Then you can chart the different decibel levels
at
distances from the unit.
Like over there, you could even see where it was going, where noise levels were going around the hill and back up over through different areas.
So what you're saying, Patrick, is some companies are doing that. We don't require it.
We don't require it. We're just getting into this noise study.
We require that their end data is below the 50 decibels or right. 55. And then they have to develop for the record how they got to that number. And we've really pushed them harder over the years to get to those numbers. But Elite Wind is different than what you guys might be doing. So we don't have a consistency of how they get to that. And now we're starting to get challenged on some of that. We have the company will come back and say, prove their own data. I think we're in a thing of, well, how do we go back and get a independent look at what the data would say? So do you find a group to subcontract out to go do an independent noise study that might confirm the company's data or show something different is kind of the next step of where this might end up at. I see it that way potentially. Because we have to make decisions and we take the company's data saying everything is fine or what? Brad. Okay.
When you just said whatever project you worked on, you didn't have to do something because the noise was such a high frequency, like how high?
I don't really remember, to be honest.
But like more than 200, you mean? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Or 200,000?
No. It wasn't up there.
Okay, so because it was so high, then that's the kind of noise that would bother somebody's dogs or something, right?
Could.
And we just don't worry about that.
That's not in our sighting criteria.
No, we did worry about it. That's what we did. We did worry about it because they sent me this data, and when I got done with it, I said, wait a minute, we still got these impacts. We have to do something about this. And they did. The manufacturer came back and said, we can do a couple things. We can make this gas tube that's coming up here. We can line the tower, and we can do this, and we can do that. And then once again, we get the and that's really all we got to go on is the manufacturer's what they say. I mean, that's what we have to go by. So we take that as gospel, basically, that they're going to reduce and dampen that frequency sound level down. So when we did that at the higher levels of frequency, that brought our whole dBA rating down within that guideline.
I see.
Okay. Anything else, Patrick? Mike?
I was hoping for a silver bullet, and I did not see one today, and I do appreciate all the information I learned quite a bit. I was hoping for some real hardcore answers, and I feel like after an hour and a half, while I don't deal with this like Pat and Jerry, I'm going to have to deal with it on a case-by-case basis, and distance is my friend.
Distance is your friend.
Sarah? Okay. Miss Alana? Okay, go back to Jerry with the microphone. Let me just mention. Don't open up Pandora's box.
Just not to. All right. It's also possible for waves to cancel each other. You can have your wave form. If you remember, you had a wave that was up like that. If you had another wave that you were broadcasting at the same time that was down like that, you could add those two waves together and cancel them out. And so it's possible to cancel noise out with noise so you don't hear anything. And that's what goes on in these headphones that you buy, these Bose headphones and stuff that are, they actually hear a noise and they see what frequency it was at and they broadcast another noise to you.
At, more than 100 bucks?
Yeah.
So just get warm at work, that. Mike.
Like a pump.
See, right there, you're talking about a controlled environment, canceling. Mm-hmm. We don't have that out here.
Yeah. All right.
Our manufacturers actually looking at stuff like that in their equipment.
What?
Noise canceling.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That was actually at Cummins Manufacturing Plant a couple weeks ago. And they've got these, I don't know, it must be 4 megawatts worth of recip generators.
Wow.
And they were showing me these noise walls that they had to put in because they're in the middle of a neighborhood. And there is air. Like, they're about as wide as from me to you. Wow. And it's just air. But if someone was to be talking and they walked around the other side of the wall, you can't hear them talk. Mm. You couldn't hear me right now. It's crazy. But
the computer is reading the wave and offset.
No, there's no computers about it. It's just
some sound absorption device.
Yeah, it basically just looks like metal panels. One here, one here, and they're perforated. It's like the inside of a muffler.
Can you see through it?
Yeah.
It's because when sound hits something, it starts to do this. And the more you can break it up, and the longer the distances you can make it travel, the less you're going to do.
Mm. Yeah, it's just,
so it sounds that industry, though, is trying to stay ahead of this because they can see what's coming.
Oh, yeah. They really are trying to. They have to.
I mean, if you're purchasing a piece of equipment and it has to meet a certain sound requirement, noise level requirement, like you said, you go back to the manufacturer and say, what can you do?
And they test these. They really, they put these through fairly rigorous testing. I know the wind turbines especially. They have a controlled environment that they test these in. That turbine, for the gas-fired turbine, it's a controlled environment that GE tests that in. And they know exactly what the sound power output of that piece of equipment is. Now, they have no control, once that piece of equipment is installed, where that power level dissipates to. But we know what it is right at the source.
And they would use that if ever challenged in court.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure enough. All right, you gentlemen got anything else?
No.
Daryl, you put a bunch of stuff together. Can you get that to all of us?
I know
you wanted
to go.
Make
copies of some of this. Some of this, I think, is pretty relevant. I would be interested in those studies you had in Denmark and whatever. If
I
you have
give
copies
you this,
of that, Skip.
I give you a study.
I did not find any of that. So.
Okay. This one is actually from 2000 and I think it was 2007 or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. And then, yeah, Daryl, if you can get us all the stuff, because thanks for setting this up for all of you guys coming out. I think this was really good, and I think the three of us will probably have some kind of follow-on discussion. But what's our threshold for subcontracting out where you put it out for bids? Is it $5,000 or
$2,500? I'm not sure. I'd have to check.
So just a ballpark, to go do a study for you guys to do, is this like a 24-hour noise study? Is this a $10,000 a thing? Is it a $2,000 thing? Just to get a range of what it might cost the commission to find someone to go do something like this for us. And this is not a hold anybody, just to, you know, because we got a process to follow. I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, I know about what it costs to site a pipeline.
Yeah.
You know, what does it cost to do a sound study, roughly?
You're the guy that makes the bills.
How many hours do you have into a one-time receptor with a report?
I can honestly say that it probably would run in the neighborhood of 4,000 to 5,000.
Okay.
For some depends on what all takes place, what all has to take place.
Okay, but the point is, it's going to be above our sole source, if you will, threshold.
It's pretty hard.
And that's fine.
It's pretty hard to travel out and spend a couple days someplace and travel back again
for less than that.
Yeah, for a couple thousand.
It's
going
to be extremely hard to do it, especially with travel time, to be under $2,500 threshold.
No, and that's what we'll probably discuss going forward, because there's at least one case in front of us now. We might need a third party, and this maybe more as time goes on. So, okay, going once, going twice, the last time. All right, we'll close the info session. Thank you all very much.
All right. Thank
you. Very informative. So
how long have you been doing this for? A while.
12 years.
It's very good to hear the man.